On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
A terror attack in Nice, France killed over 80 people attending Bastille Day celebrations. And after some false starts, Donald Trump chose Indiana Governor Mike Pence to be his running mate. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and on the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Welcome to you both. So it feels like we've been having these conversations a lot more often lately. There was a mass killing on the French Riviera on Thursday where a man armed with several guns drove a truck into celebrating crowds in the city of Nice just after Bastille Day fireworks. The attacker was ultimately killed, the windshield of his truck shot through with bullet holes, but not before he killed so many people and injured dozens of others, many of them still on life support in hospitals. Before I go to our panelists, we have by phone our frequent guest, Juliette Kayyem, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. Juliette, I wanted to ask you about what looks to me like the alarming simplicity of this attack, because I feel like a lot of the attacks we've seen in recent years have fallen in two categories, either complex ones like the one last fall in Paris, which involve a large group of conspirators. Not that many people can carry out those sort of attacks, and the large number of people involved makes them vulnerable to surveillance and infiltration. I feel like we sort of have an idea of what governments do to stop those sorts of plots. And then we've had lone wolf attacks, which are harder to detect, but usually less deadly, often because the lone wolf is not very good at carrying out the plot, as with the attacker whose gun jammed on a high-speed train between Paris and Brussels last year. What looks unusually scary to me about this attack is that it killed so many people and it looked so simple. And I'm wondering what you think. Should we worry that we're going to see more attacks like this using widely available vehicles as weapons where it's not really obvious what to do to stop these kinds of attacks?
Right. Unfortunately, yes. Although I should say that, for at least over the last 6 years, the desire of first Al-Qaeda and then ISIS to use both cars and trucks and to motivate their people to use cars and trucks to kill, Westerners and infidels has been in their literature. So people were anticipating it. But like you said, unlike a sniper or others, this is really hard to stop. I mean, that was a big truck going relatively quickly down a street in which you just couldn't evacuate in time. And I think we are in a different wave. I wrote down the last couple of months you and I have been together, right? I've been coming on the show: Istanbul, Orlando, Baghdad, Brussels, Dakar, Nice, Paris, and then beginning, of course, with Je Suis Charlie. And there is no common theme, Josh. I mean, some are terrorist-directed, some terrorist-inspired, some well-planned, others rudimentary. Some involve nationals of the country they're victimized, others foreigners. Some are highly lethal, and some, are no different than a night in Chicago. And so all I can say is, I think what, quite honestly, the French leadership said this morning, that we just need to learn to live with this, that is essentially where we are right now.
But what does that mean? I mean, I can buy into that in the broad sense that often tragedies have no particular policy implication. Terrible things will happen in the world that you can't do much about. But given a body count like this, depending on what we see about how often this sort of attack is replicated, it seems to me likely to be something that's unacceptable to just say, well, we're just going to have to live with this.
Well, I agree with you on that, but this is, an example of one. So in other words, you don't want to shift your entire counterterrorism and defensive strategy based on one, no matter how horrible it is. And that may sound harsh. So part of this is, and the reason why you don't is simply because to stop this kind of attack, would essentially mean urban living would have to change dramatically. And you live in New York. I mean, we just aren't there yet. But obviously, in terms of stopping them when they're in progress, I do think we have to think of more highly lethal weaponry, especially for events like that. My understanding is that a lot of the police were not armed in Paris for reasons that don't make sense. In Nice, for reasons that don't make sense to me right now. So we are going to have to think about how you would stop these when in action. But what the kind of defensive strategy you would need to stop these kinds of attacks is essentially, you know, closing New York City. And that's just, we're just not there yet. And so, you know, you continue to try to, you know, stop ISIS abroad and deal with the motivation. But in this case in Nice, this guy, Mohamed Goulel is I don't know if he was terrorist directed, terrorist inspired or what yet. I mean, it's hard to tell what this guy was.
Well, Juliet, thank you so much for joining us. Even under the circumstances, I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Josh, and thanks, everyone.
So, Katrina and Rich, this has been as I've been looking at this, the thing that I'm a little despondent about is that, it seems to me, as Juliet was describing, it's not really obvious that there's anything in particular to do about this. Maybe you need more police with more high-powered rifles of the sort that we see around big landmarks in New York City, Grand Central, and things like that. But is this looks to me like it could be a thing that both there's no obvious policy response to, and that it's not going to be okay to say to people, there's no obvious policy response to this, we have to live with it.
Unfortunately, it seems though ISIS has hit on this model that really works for them, and it doesn't involve big, complicated attacks most of the time. And if one guy can do this with a truck, you know, pretty much anyone can do this with anything. And I still think the appropriate response is to crush the caliphate, to do what we can to help moderate Muslims win the ideological war within Islam. But if we continue to suffer these attacks with regularity, you are going to see Western societies beginning to establish defenses around such events that you would associate with Israel.
You know, I was reading something this morning, which, first of all, the litany of horror is something important to note, and grief and sympathy to the victims of those who died and were maimed and injured in Nice. But, you know, since their invention at the end of the 19th century, motor vehicles have been agencies of terror and death. I mean, there was an incident in this city. First car bomb was Buddha's wagon, which blasted Wall Street in 1920. It is the case that what we need to look hard at, it's not as simple. There are no simple policy responses. But policing and intelligence, finding a solution to the Syrian conflict, these are no easy tasks. But I do think what we've learned, Josh, is that years of bitter experience demonstrate that U.S. military intervention in the Middle East has done more to provoke extremism than to stanch it. And I think the idea that we can somehow prevent such attacks by armed response is a distraction from, again, the intelligence and policing. Politically, these are times not for easy answers. I do think it strengthens the right-wing populism in Europe. I think it strengthens the anti-immigration forces, the national sovereigntist political forces. And by extension, politically in this country, it will be interesting to see where these horrific attacks lead. But these are not times for thinking military action is going to resolve. This is a new form, as you were saying, Josh, these are new forms of terrorism. Lone wolf, a car. These are homegrown. So when someone says we have to stop Syrian immigration to this country, it doesn't even address the real issue. As we know, Orlando was very different. What we see in San Bernardino, these were people born in this country.
But it seems to me here like the Syria question's a little bit beside the point, in that it's not clear that ISIS had anything in particular to do with this attack. And even if they were, even if we find out that we don't have any indication of this yet, that this person was specifically inspired by ISIS, it's not obvious to me that crushing the caliphate does anything to stop future inspired attacks. It's, you know, if an idea is out there, taking Raqqa back from ISIS won't kill the idea. Gun control is hard enough. You can't stop people from having trucks. it's not obvious to me that there is an effective response here, even if it would have been helpful to prevent the rise of ISIS so that this idea would not have spread that it did. It's not clear to me that now crushing ISIS is going to do very much to stop the idea.
Well, it wouldn't stop every one of these attacks, obviously, but having success on the ground does lend more prestige to the idea. And the more successful and powerful an idea is, the more alluring it's going to seem to people. Now, you could take back Mosul and Raqqa and all the rest of it tomorrow, and the idea will still exist, but it would be marginally less powerful. But I'm not suggesting you're going to win this war today, tomorrow, or even 5-10 years from now. It's a long ideological struggle, but part of it is not allowing radical Islam to have a headquarters it can brag about.
Got to bring history to bear. These are problems that have been brewing for years. If you just want to take the example of France, you've had second and third generation immigrants who have been disaffected, who have been dissatisfied with their lives. They latch onto ISIS as an ideology of way of giving voice to their deeply held anger and grievances. In the changing face of terrorism, the changing face of war, traditional military action to retake cities, I think you were pointing to this, Josh, it's not clear that that's going to address some of, and Juliet was right, these are not, you can't say we're seeing a pattern. It's individual too. So we need to think more nimbly. And my last point is, let's not throw more money at these agencies. I think what's insane is we have the tools, but the coordination we see in so many of these incidents, there's been something dropped, something lost. Some agency hasn't talked to another. 9/11, for example, the great mistake was to call it a war. You don't wage war on an odious, horrific ideology. And I think we need lawful policing, intelligence, all those tools, but not massive intervention, not occupation of countries, which I come back to have bred more extremists than they have stopped it.
But you do wage war on ideologies. We wage war on Nazism. We wage war on communism.
That was a massive land army. Soviets, massive land army. Nazi Germany, massive land army.
Well, there it's a difference in that they were associated more directly with nation states, but it was an ideological and military struggle. And the same thing is here. Now, it doesn't have the same military aspect. We're not rolling armored divisions, at least not now, into Syria or Iraq, but it does matter if they hold territory and can defy their enemies and recruit people.
But
it was the U.S. invasion of Iraq,
which in some ways led directly, indirectly to the birth of ISIS. I think massive occupation of territory is been shown time and time again in these last 15, 20 years to have done little to provide for more security in this country or in countries like France.
But the thing I see when you look at attacks like this is you wage war against countries and people who have territories, and you do surveillance and policing operation against illegal organizations that commit organized crime. Neither of those models really applies against an extremely distributed approach where the only thing that's shared is the idea. And I mean, this guy was not on the radar of French surveillance authorities.
Paris were on the radar. Surveillance does play a vital role. And
right.
I think we have seen again the communications have been dropped. You know, that the intensity of approach needs to be dedicated, it seems to me, those tools: policing, surveillance, intelligence. And I think you have seen, for the most part, those tools would have played a more positive, effective role.
Is there anything in an organized manner to be done about sort of getting people to go on about their business as unfazed as possible
Absolutely.
By these sorts of... But so how do you do that?
Rich brought up history. I love when Rich brings up history. This country has faced far greater threats. I don't want to speak for France. I'm not French. World War II, the Civil War. This country is a great country of resilience. And I think Juliet said it, citing the French, I think the foreign minister, we must go on. I hate to think of it as the new normal, but when 9/11 hit this country, Europe looked at us and said, we've lived with forms of terrorism for decades, Ireland, other places. So I do think we need to retrieve the strength and resilience of this country's greatest character and not bow to fear. And my sense, Rich may disagree, is that we are out from 9/11, where Americans are still anxious, but they're war weary and they're not as fearful. though, of course, these attacks coming relentlessly, who cannot be just horrified?
Well, if we have an Orlando-style attack in this country every 6 months, you'll begin to see armed guards in places that you never would have thought you'd see them. I mean, you just will. And France, I mean, it's really suffering a low-level terrorist insurgency. And it has to do, not entirely, but in part, with a large Muslim population that is only loosely assimilated. And there's really not much France can do about that now. But if I were another European country, I would do everything I could to avoid importing potentially the same problem within my borders.
That's what I start. I mean, I said that I think this attack, sadly, will empower the far-right populist forces, will those countries which want to shut borders. And let's be honest, we've been seeing it over this last year. This will just embolden and accelerate those tendencies.
Let us know what you think about the Bastille Day attack at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Donald Trump and Mike Pence. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Check out KCRW's all news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. So after a number of shifts and false starts and leaks and denials that the leaks meant anything, Donald Trump announced on Friday morning on Twitter that his running mate for the presidency will be Indiana Governor Mike Pence. Pence is known as a social conservative, but he's probably most known nationally as the governor who signed Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Law, which would have made it easier for businesses to discriminate against LGBT people, and the governor who then moved to swiftly undo the most controversial aspects of that law under pressure from business leaders who feared economic boycotts of the state. And this was an episode that endured him really neither to conservatives nor to liberals. Rich, what do you make of this pick? I know you wrote a very entertaining column this week about why Donald Trump's ticket soulmate was Newt Gingrich. So this is not the call you would have made.
Yeah, well, I think Trump's running a media campaign, so go with the most compelling media figure on offer, which would have been Newt Gingrich, although obviously Newt had obvious downsides himself, given that he could match Donald Trump for controversial statement to controversial statement. So Trump went with what appears to be the safe choice. It's the choice Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell will be most pleased with. And it's a sign that, at least on this matter, he was willing to do what the party wanted him to do. But it won't look so safe if Pence has real trouble defending Trump. And it's not always easy to do. The example of that Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana, where he totally blew the case for it on national TV, is not highly encouraging about how he'll perform as a Trump defender. But you always, with these picks, you have about a 72-hour period of peril. And if you don't have an utter memorable debacle, you're probably going to be okay. And I imagine Donald Trump has every expectation a week from now he'll completely forget that Mike Pence is his running mate.
The rap on Mike Pence, and Matt Iglesias from Vox had a fair amount of role in developing this rap, is that he is not very bright. Is that fair? Because that seems to me like, you know, the challenge of reacting to whatever new thing Donald Trump says is a thing that you need a fairly large intellect to be able to figure out what nonsense to say. My sense is that Mike Pence is not that guy.
I have never had a sense of him as being a dull tool in the shed, but he's not like a effervescent intellectual presence like Newt Gingrich is, who's always, you know, bubbling up with some new idea or other.
Newt wanted to be the pirate along with the team of pirates, as he told Sean Hannity. No, I mean, I think, you know, Newt said, I was telling Rich this, Newt said today or yesterday that Mr. Pence would bring Midwestern appeal to the Trump ticket and would pair Mr. Trump with a, quote, relatively stable, more normal person, which I, but I mean, what he's done is what Rich said. I mean, what he's done, there's a lot out there on the internet right now. He's the most extremist, most divisive. But what he's essentially, Pence is the consummate insider. And so you have the man who's running as the outsider, challenging the establishment, kind of neutering himself, it seems to me, with his pick. And if, you know, on substance, if I might, I don't care if this guy's smart or not, but he's certainly been opposed to Trump's signature trade, anti-trade policies, which ain't going to play too well if people pay any attention to Pence in those key states which Trump is vying for. Obviously, trade is a proxy for more, and Pence, I think, can play well on anti-immigration. But he's, you know, he's pretty traditional. And so Trump showed his cards. He wants to play with the movement. He wants to play with the, I don't know if he wants, Kochs have said they're not going to give money even though they like Mike Pence. But it's traditional.
Well, one thing we also learned this week, there was this weird leak of this letter from the host committee. It's basically a bunch of local executives in Cleveland who run the committee that raises all the money to put on the convention. They need like over $80 million to put this party on. And they're $6 million short. And so they wrote this letter to Sheldon Adelson saying, will you please give us $6 million? And listing individually the people and entities who had promised to give money to the convention and then didn't because they were too embarrassed by Donald Trump, including $1 million that David Koch was supposed to give. And so I'm not surprised the convention's running short on fundraising because it makes sense that companies are running away. The thing I think is really weird is that this letter got written and got out. Like, you'd think if you desperately needed $6 million from Sheldon Adelson because everything was going really wrong, you'd call him on the phone. So what do you make of that? Is there somebody inside, either is it Adelson or somebody inside the RNC who's trying to embarrass Trump? It seems like yet another sign of the fact that the party is very unhappy about where it landed.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, the leadership of the RNC is fully on board with Trump, mm-hmm. but there are a lot of people within the organization that aren't so happy with his nomination. You know, I think this letter, it's embarrassing, but the bigger and for Trump the better news is just that an effort to unbind the delegates completely mm-hmm. fizzled. So he should have a halfway decent convention. And I think if he does that, he'll be tied or leading a week from now in the national polls.
I mean, I think the bigger scandal, and it's bipartisan, both parties, they've sold off these conventions every year. These big corporations, these big givers pump up the money. And if you tell me there's no pay to play and they don't get special access because of that, I got a bridge to sell you. But that's a whole other story. But there's another thing going on with the Republican convention, of course, concern about what's going to go on in the streets. You got an open carry city. But Color of Change has launched a boycott. The platform, I don't know what Rich thinks of it, but people probably know Tony Perkins, Family Research Council. You know, this is
leading social conservative.
This is sort of Phyllis Schlafly, if people remember her. This is her dream. I mean, this platform is really socially conservative. I'm not even talking about, it's really, I think, out of touch even with young conservatives on LGBT issues, on other issues. And there is a boycott. And big corporations have stayed away from Cleveland because they just feel it's you know, so clueless in terms of the changing demographics and cultural, social nature of this country. And it goes back to the freedom, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which Pence bungled.
Well,
and
Trump has, I assure you, just to reassure you, Katrina, has no idea what's in the platform. And,
no,
and
I think you're
care.
Right, which is
and
interesting.
This is the huge irony of his yeah, candidacy. He's much more centrist than the rest of the party. But you look, there's a poll just the last day or two that showed, you know, one of the words people associate most with Trump is extremist, when he's actually more moderate when you get
five,
down on the number
five
of these things.
Four and five evangelicals are supporting 4 out of 5.
But I don't think that's a contradiction. You can have positions that on average mm-hmm. place you somewhere in the middle of the spectrum and still have right. a bunch of positions that are very extreme. I mean, back when Donald Trump was going to run for president as an independent in the 2000 election, he was for a 13% national wealth tax, right. which I would call a fairly extreme left position. He's a guy who latches on to ideas that are outside the mainstream in a way that is, you know, currently directed in a nationalist, fairly racist direction. But I don't think it's, you know, I don't think he is unextreme just because he is not a heterodox.
I do think Pence is going to hurt him. Maybe he's already hurt, but Pence is going to hurt him with women. The suburban Republican women, they're going to take a hard look at, we have on our site right now, our correspondent Joan Walsh says Pence is like more soft-spoken Todd Akin. People can remember Todd Akin from a few years ago talking about rape and poo-pooing it. So I think it's dangerous for Trump in terms of that.
Right,
important
but Todd Akin would have been wouldn't have been Todd Akin if he hadn't said what he said.
And yeah, but just, the record, just Pence record, is pretty
assuming
tough.
Pence can avoid a humongous gaffe, I just don't think he's going to play much one way or the other.
But this is the weird thing to me about Pence, is that Pence has, you know, a long reputation as a social conservative, you know, has, you know, a number of statements on the record, you know, back in 2000 trying to tie to an AIDS funding bill that we need to take money away from organizations that are celebrating, you know, basically gay sexual practices and toward people who will change their sexual practices, look like a reference to reparative therapy.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, his big best known social issue foray involved him totally caving on a thing that social conservatives care about. So while the left is out there painting him as this extremist social conservative, is he really somebody that social conservatives are going to be at all eager about? Do they view him as someone who has their back?
I think among the leadership of social conservative groups, they all know and like Mike Pence. So it helps them get on board a little bit more with Trump, although most of them are already on board. In terms of kind of grassroots, ordinary social conservatives, I don't think most of them know or care who Mike Pence is. And again, unless there's some debacle, This is going to be a pick that's going to be forgotten in 2 weeks.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
At the memorial service for the Dallas police officers, George W. Bush had an arresting formulation. He said, "Too often we judge other groups by their worst examples while judging ourselves with our best intentions." And I think all of us fall prey to that at a certain level, and it's a good reminder that we should try to extend a sympathetic understanding to the other side and have a certain modesty about our own correctness and righteousness. Although I will say, I still disagree with everything Katrina says.
Katrina, what's your rant?
Well, I have to say I don't disagree with everything Rich says, because I think, you know, you can find points of agreement and disagree on other things. My rant has to do, the media is doing better with Trump, but we're still living in this kind of post-factual environment. Not entirely new in this country, but Trump's taking it to new extremes. And what he said about crime being totally out of control, he's out of control. What he said about groups holding moment of silence for the sniper in Dallas, it's a lie, it's a lie, it's a lie. And that word has been diminished in impact because Donald Trump has taken us into a new era of post-factual politics.
For my rant, I want to highlight a very interesting piece that Raihan Salam and Ross Douthat wrote for the New York Times this week, trying to outline their hopeful vision of a post-Trump Republican Party, basically trying to synthesize some of the more valid complaints the Trump coalition has while stripping away the core of racist sentiment that seems to be at the center of it. And the idea is basically to combine a platform that includes a significant amount of immigration restriction with more of an acceptance of a significant entitlement state that shields people against economic dislocation, and most importantly, abandons the Republican quest for tax cuts for the rich, because that is a thing that puts so much fiscal pressure on anything else you might do that might mollify people of low to moderate incomes who feel upset about globalization, that you don't want to mollify by just blaming everything on Mexicans. I fear that there isn't a terribly deep political coalition for what they're laying out, but I think it is the best case option for trying to appeal to the Trump voters without Trumpism. I'm hopeful that what we're going to see from Theresa May in the United Kingdom as they have a leadership transition will be a model for this, that she might show what a responsible conservative party can look like in today's Western democracies. But my general outlook right now on U.S. politics is despair, so I am not holding my breath for that. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry and Katrina Vandenhoevel. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.